how it works. Yeah. Okay, I think we better get started. There is a sufficient number of slides that we have to cover today again. Last week we talked about symmetric crypto. Today we'll cover asymmetric crypto, but we'll start with hash functions. There it is. So that was the general agenda. Now we'll focus on the hash functions. So what is a hash function? A hash function is actually a function that takes it's a deterministic function, so same input means same output, that takes a string of arbitrary length and changes that into a string of a fixed length in a deterministic way. So we start with anything, can be an empty string, can be extremely long, and out comes something in this particular case of length n. And we'll just talk about binary strings here. So the goal is to produce something of fixed length, because that's what we often like in crypto, because then we can control what the crypto function will be doing if we take a fixed length as input. Some typical values of that length is 128, MD4 and MD5, and then it became 160 in SHA-1, and now even the length is getting longer and longer, up to 256 bits for SHA-2 and SHA-3, all examples of hash functions. There are some security requirements for a hash function. There are actually three. The first one is one-wayness. So given a hash function and given an input, I can easily calculate what the output is. I have a description of the function. That should be easy anyway. But given an output, it should not be easy to find what input actually will lead to that particular output. So given the output of the hash function, y, what should I give as input x to the hash function to get this output? Finding x should be difficult. That's the first requirement. Then a bit stronger is weak collision resistance. I have an input value, x0. Okay, if I have an input value, I can calculate the output of the hash function. That's y0. Can I now find another input function, input value that actually hashes to that same value? Yeah, why is this more restrictive? Because in the beginning, I can just pick whatever I want. I pick a y and try to find an x to that. Now I'm actually given x0, so I'm given also y0. And so I'm restricted. I can't pick y by myself. And I can go one step further. I can actually give you freedom in the x's also. Can I find any two x's, x0 and x1, that will hash to the same value? That's called strong collision resistance. Yeah, if a function is strong collision resistant, obviously it's also weak collision resistant. So these are the security requirements that we put on a hash function. Should be one way, should be weak collision resistance, and should be strong collision resistance. A good hash function will possess the avalanche function. An avalanche is when the snow comes down a hill, and so it starts small and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and takes more and more snow with it. Same with the hash function. If I change one bit in the input, in the internal process, that one change will spread over to a large range. So one bit change in the input bit, one bit change in the input will lead to, let's say, half of the output bits changing. Approximately half. It should be easy to compute because we want to use the hash functions. So it should be easy to compute in hardware or in software. And one thing, we talked about collisions and we talked about collision resistance, but collisions do exist. Simply look at the number of different inputs, which is infinity. Any string, length 0, 1, 2, 3, up to infinity. So there is an infinite number of inputs, but there is just a finite number of outputs. The length is, of the output is n bits, so I have at maximum 2 to the power n different output bits. So there will be many, many, many inputs that will hash to the same value. Problem is I can't find them. That's the security. There are different constructions. There is a block cipher construction. I will discuss that at the end. The dedicated hash functions, they have particular structures, like we discussed in symmetric crypto. Also, you had the Faisal structure. You had the substitution permutation network. You have different structure, different construction methods here too. We have the MD4 family, which includes MD5, SHA-1, and SHA-2. Then SHA-3 actually is a new type of construction, and there will be other constructions also. Not going into too many details here. Here you see some of the input and output parameters. MD5 will process 128-bit blocks at a time. We'll give 128-bit output, but will process 512-bit block at a time. It's, again, an iterative process. Like in the Faisal structure and SPI networks, it will have 64 rounds. And yeah, you see the outputs for the other ones also. It's not that important. Here you see the Miracle Dumb Guard Construction, MD, MD4, MD5. So that comes from these two guys. You start with some kind of initial value and a function that takes that value as input plus a block of the text that I'm, of the input that I'm trying to hash. Yeah, and after that f function, actually the second time I call the f function, the result from the previous f function is used as the initial value and the next block of the message. And so I keep doing that at, until the very end. At the end, there is always padding to make sure that the length of my input is a multiple of the block size that it's working on. And then the result of the last f function will be what we call the hash. So one of the most well-known hash functions is SHA-1. You can see it here. So actually that ABCDE, that's the block that is coming in from the left-hand side in the previous picture. And actually the message block is coming through the W values. And there is a number of constants, H0 up to H4, which take the value of A to E in the beginning. So that's the initial value, H0 up to H4. And then there is an addition at the bottom right part of KI values. And depending on, there are 80 rounds, depending on what round I am in, I add a different value. So the first 20 rounds, the value, the hexadecimal value 5A87827999 is added. And then for different rounds, different values. The H values are just used in the beginning, initial value, right? So the initial value coming at ABCDE and the message coming at WT, that will result at the very end after 80 rounds in a new value of ABCDE. That will be the input on the top for the next time that the F function is run. And one F function is this 80 rounds. There is an F function that's a bit complicated if they use the same name in two places. There is an F function there also. Let's call the global one the round function. There is a small F function there. Again, that one depends on the round that we're in. Per 20 rounds, we'll change that. So there are four different values there also. Four different functions there also. That one I mentioned. This is that that small F function up there, the green block. Let's see, the second round 20 to 39, it just simply takes these three blocks and XORs them. B, XOR, C, XOR, D. Yeah? Each of these blocks, A, B, C, D, E, is a 32-bit value. So the total length is 160 bits. There is two shifts there, cyclic shifts. Cyclic shift over 5 positions and over 30 positions. To the left in both cases. Cyclic shift over 30 positions to the left is actually the same as a right cyclic shift over 2 positions. That's nothing new. And then the red block with the plus, that's an addition modulo 2 to the power 32, which is simply just adding two values and forgetting if there is any carry bit. Nothing more, nothing less. So the only thing that we haven't explained in the full construction, I know the initial H to E value. I know how these are forwarded to the next round. I know about the yellow blocks. I know about the green block. I know about the K values from the previous slide. The only thing that I haven't explained is the W values. That's where the text comes in. And this is how SHA does that, SHA-1. SHA is working on blocks of 512 bits. So it takes 512 bits from the message and it processes them. Each of these 512 bits are split into 16 32-bit values. So W0 to W15 is, in principle, just the input text. And that's used then in the first 16 rounds. And then from round 17 up to round 80, we are just creating, based on previous values of the W values, we're just creating new ones. So we're taking the input text and combining various values of that and then getting new values. and again a cyclic left shift over one position there when we combine them. Yeah, so in principle, now you have all the details to make your own implementation of SHA. SHA-1 in this case, there are different versions of SHA. Is that clear? Yeah, it's a simple description, I guess. The operations on the bits are not that complicated. It's a cyclic shift, XOR, adding, normal adding, etc., etc. You saw that the only input to the hash function is the text block, W. Yeah? The initial value, that's fixed. There is no key or whatever in SHA. So this is what we call an unkeyed hash. Everybody can calculate it. If I have my implementation, you have your implementation. If we run it on the same input, we should get the same output. Simple. But sometimes we need a keyed hash function. And in a keyed hash function, there is also some secret input. So even though the message is the same, the keys are different, and then we get different outputs. So here's a way of doing this. This is called HMAC. Described in a request for comments 2104. And I have a key, simply a string of bits, randomly, a message, and a hash function. And what I hash is first K1 concatenated with a message. That will give me a result. In case of SHA-1, that will be a 160-bit result. And then I concatenate K2 with that result I just got, and I hash that again. And K1 and K2 are just derived in a simple way from K, just by flipping some bits, different bits from K1 and K2. So I can use, as a hash function in there, in the HMAC, I can just use SHA-1 or MD5 or whatever I want. Yeah, but this is a way to include, to turn a unkeyed hash function into a keyed hash function. We also refer then to this as a message authentication code. So this is a specific construction in the MD family of hash functions. If we base something on a block cipher, we can do that too. A block cipher takes a key and a message and produces some ciphertext. Well, we can use that. So I'll split up my message again in a number of blocks, M1 up to MX in this particular case. And then I'll take M1 and I encrypt that with the given key. So this is a keyed hash again. And the result of that, I XOR to M2. I forget the result. I forget the temporary result, the intermediate result. I just use that result to XOR to the next message block and encrypt that again. The result is again encrypted to the next message block, etc., etc., until the very end. So normally in symmetric crypto, what we did is sending all these intermediate results such that the receiver could decrypt it. In this case, we forget about it and we only look at the very end, that result, and we use that one. Yeah, that's the description of it. Yeah, and you can have variations to this, of course. I could use not the same key everywhere. I could change the key in a known way. So the first round I use a key, the second round I use that key XORed with 1 and then XORed with 2, or maybe plus 1 and plus 2 or whatever. Yeah, so I can make changes to that. Then the last, where I will not give a description, is SHA-3. Same as with DES, that was invented in 1977, that got old and insecure at some point in time, and so there was a competition by NIST at the end of the 90s to come up with a new encryption algorithm that became AES. Same for the hash functions. MD5 was at some point broken because there could be collisions found. And SHA-1 came at some point that became insecure also. And so NIST came with a competition for a new hash function that should have a larger output, not just 160 bits. That was considered insecure. It should be larger, 256 bits. The winner of that was a cipher call or a hash function called KESSUC, by a group of people from mostly from Belgium. Let me see. Yeah, all of them are from Belgium. And note that Joan Dahlman is also the person that was involved in the AES description. So he probably knows a bit about crypto. This algorithm uses what is called a sponge construction, but I will not go into details here, just as a term. It's a new type of construction, so it doesn't fall within the Merkle-Damgaard family of hash functions. That was very brief, very short, what I wanted to say on hash functions. Any questions? I haven't really said why hash functions are needed. That will be in the next set of slides. When we talk about asymmetric crypto, then all of a sudden you'll see that you actually can use these kinds of things. Yeah? What do you mean by hash encryption? In principle, what I... You saw the picture in Blackboard that I use for a hash function. You put in meat and you get some kind of spaghetti meat out, right? You can't recognize from the output what the input was. That is, in principle, a characteristic of any encryption function. Also, that from the encrypted text, from the ciphertext, I can't see what the plain text was. No, hash functions and ciphers have different functions. Yeah. So a cipher, a symmetric crypto cipher, has the purpose of making sure that the communication of sending a message to the other side happens in a secure way that somebody who sees that message can't find the plain text back. A hash function is, as I said on one of the first slides, just taking an arbitrary input and hashing it to a fixed length output, 160 bits, 256 bits, or whatever. Yeah, that's the purpose of a hash function. How that is used in the next slide deck. Yeah. Other questions? Then let me stop this one. And we continue with asymmetric crypto. Yeah, in the overview, asymmetric crypto now. I started very funny with Alice and Bob the first time when I talked about symmetric crypto, and I had these dictionaries. I will not do that now. In symmetric crypto, we said this is called symmetric crypto because the encryption key and the decryption key are the same. There is symmetry in that. Asymmetric crypto, by default, means that the encryption key and the decryption key are not the same. They're related, of course, but they are not the same. Every person will have two keys, one for encryption and one for decryption. And the one of these keys, the one that is used for encryption, so if you want to send a message to me and you need to encrypt it for me, that key I can give out to everybody. That's called a public key also. The other one, I'll keep to myself. That's the private key or the secret key, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. It's also called public key crypto because you give away this one part of the key. And even though I give away one part of the key and the keys are linked together, it's still obviously difficult that if you have this information, and anybody can have that information, you can't find back this one. Generally, the encryption and decryption algorithm are the same, but as they have different keys as input, the result is one time an encryption from the plaintext to the ciphertext, and the other time it's from the ciphertext to the plaintext. Examples: Diffie-Hellman, RSA, Elgamal, Elliptic Curve Crypto. We'll see a few of them. We'll see Diffie-Hellman and RSA in particular. So asymmetric crypto. Some general introduction first. Everybody has access or can have access to the public key. There's no secrecy in that. It's really public. Must not be possible to derive the private key, obviously. I said that just a minute ago. And if you send me a message, if you send Alice a message, then I'll take Alice's public key. I will use that for the encryption, and then I will send it to her. And because she is the only one who has a private key, she is the only one who can decrypt it. Even I can't decrypt it anymore. So here, Alice again. Alice wants to do public key crypto, asymmetric crypto, and she has a key pair, public key and a private key. And she publishes the public key, available to everybody, in green, and she keeps the private key to herself, so that's red. And so Bob can get this public key. And Carol and Dave, everybody has access to this public key. In fact, even Eve, who's evil, eavesdropper, yeah, she also has access to this public key. So it's not like we're keeping it for some people and I only can share it with the persons that I want to communicate with. Assume that everybody has that. So now what happens? Bob wants to send a message to Alice, as usual. So Bob comes up with a message, M. And then he wants to send that to Alice. So how does he do that? Well, he encrypts it using Alice's public key. So the encryption of the, that's, maybe I should use different colors next year. So the encryption of the message M with the public key of Alice, and then Alice can take her private key and that encrypted message and retrieve back the message from that. Or hopefully retrieve back the message from that. Last week we had the dictionaries to show what symmetric crypto was. Yeah, everybody had a different key, and so only the one with the same key as where I did the encryption with, that person could decrypt. So an analogy for asymmetric crypto then. The public key is this kind of lock, padlock is called. Yeah? Everybody, if you have that, you can lock it, very easy. But the only one with a private key can unlock it. And the way that I do encryption is I have this box, and I'll put, if I want to send something to Alice, I'll take Alice's public key, I'll put my message in the box, and I'll put the padlock on it, and I'll close it. Yeah, the only one who has then, I don't have access to that message anymore, it's in the box. I can open the padlock. Only one who can open that is Alice, who has that particular private key. She can open the padlock, open the box, and look at the message. And keys distribution is simple. I just have a bunch of these padlocks. I'll just throw them out here, and everybody who wants to send me something just takes that padlock, puts it on, and sends it to me. Yeah, all of these are identical. All of these work to the same key, of course. So this is asymmetric crypto. It's very new. It started in 1976 with a very good paper of Whitfield Diffie and Martin Hellman. If you're interested in this, just go. It's available online. And they introduced Diffie-Hellman encryption, DH. Asymmetric crypto. For symmetric crypto, we had these constructions, Feistel substitution permutation networks. Asymmetric crypto is based on difficult mathematical problems. I'm guessing that some of you think that every mathematical problem is difficult, but yeah, it's maybe not as difficult. I will give you some examples of real difficult mathematical problems, but there's no solution. Let's start with an easy problem, multiplication. Multiplication is easy. We can do that, right? Can we? Okay, we can. Then let's see if we can do that. I will give you an exercise. First one to have the answer, just shout it out. Let's see how long that takes. Yeah, just shout. Yeah, exactly. 209. How do we do that? Well, 11 is 10 plus 1, so I know that 10 times 19 is 190. 1 times 19 is 19. And then I'll add them up, and I'll get to 209. Very good. Very easy. We have an algorithm to do that. Yeah. If I give you two 10-digit numbers, you can multiply them. Yeah, not by head, but you can use pen and paper, and you can do the multiplication. If you can multiply everything between 0 times 0 and 9 times 9, and you can do additions, you can do any multiplication at all. So there is an algorithm for that. So let's look at something more difficult. Factorization. Actually, that's the opposite of multiplication, right? 11 times 19 is 209. That's one way. The other way is from 209 finding out what 11 times that it is 11 times 19. Now here's an issue again, a problem again. Not 209, but let's go a bit up. What's P and Q? At least it took longer. That's good. Proves my point. Anybody? It's two primes. You're nodding as if you have the answer. Do you have it? No. Are you trying? Nothing yet? It's really point proven. Yeah? Yeah, 13 times 17, I can do that. 13 times 17, where's the pen? Here's the pen. Let's see. 10 times 17 is 170. 3 times 17 is 51. And if I add them up, yeah, I'll get to. So it was 13 times 17. How do we get to 13 times 17? Well, for multiplication, we have an algorithm. For factorization, we just try. Is that number, is it divisible by 3? No. 5? No. 7? No. 9? Oh, 9 I don't need to check because it's not divisible by 3. 11? No. 13? Oh, yes. Divisible by 13, and I'll get, as a result, 17, which is prime. Okay, done. So there is an algorithm, but it takes quite sometimes, specifically if we're talking about not three-digit numbers, but let's say 100-digit numbers, 300-digit numbers, whatever. Yeah, so generally there is no efficient way to do factorization. There is an efficient way to do multiplication, but not factorization. It's a difficult problem. That is, in fact, used in RSA. Here's another one. Modular exponentiation. I want to calculate g to the power x modulo p, where g, x, and p are given. And I'll give you a problem again. What is 2 to the power 7 modulo 11? Somebody should have this. 2 to the power 7, 128. 11 times 11, 121. So 128 modulo 11 is 7. Again, simple algorithm. I can do these calculations. I can easily do exponentiation. I can easily do modulo calculation, and I can come to that. There is an efficient algorithm for that. The other way around. Given, so now I gave you 2 and 7 and 11. What if I don't give you this 7? What if I give you the ground power, the modulo, and the result? Find the power. To what power did I raise? In this case, I have the same, more or less the same example. What should this power have been if the result should have been 6? There's one way of finding it out. What if it was 1, 2 to the power 1 modulo 11. No, 2 to the power 2. No, 3. No, 4. Just again, try. And actually, you'll find out that the answer is 9. So 2 to the power 9 modulo 11 is 6. You can check that for yourself. Yeah, so what we found out is one way. Was the easy way, the way back is difficult. Given X, I can find Y easily. Given Y, I have to do a tremendous job in finding X. And this problem is used in Diffie-Hellman. There are obviously some advantages in asymmetric crypto and disadvantages. Key distribution, keys in general, is much easier. I have one key pair, that is. I have my private key and I have my public key that I publish somewhere. And if I want to send something to you, I'll look up your public key and then I'll use that. Or maybe I have it on my hard disk. But in principle, for every person, I have one key only. Way less keys. The key distribution, to make sure that everybody gets my public key, it's easier. I'll just write it on a note and put it here, and everybody can read it. Instead of that, I have to go and visit everybody with a separate key. And symmetric crypto could be used for confidentiality, but asymmetric crypto can also be used for integrity and authentication. So I can do much more with it. Disadvantage is it's mathematics. It's a lot of calculations. Yeah, and computers are fast, but still the block ciphers are much, and the stream ciphers are much faster than asymmetric crypto. So it's much slower. Let's go into two different examples of asymmetric crypto, RSA and Diffie-Hellman, before I go into these last two parts. RSA is a crypto system based on a paper by Rivers, Shamir, and Edelman. Actually, that paper was rejected first because of not being practical. Luckily, it was accepted somewhere else later on. Based on the difficulty of factorization, as I said before, and if you want to read something about very important papers in science that were rejected once, you have to go and look up. We are sorry to inform you. Yeah, this paper, very important crypto system, was first rejected simply because the reviewer had no idea what these people were talking about. I'll give you a description of RSA, but I'll make many, many side steps to explain all the parts in between. Security of RSA is based on factorization. Yeah, before we can do factorization, we have to choose two large prime first. And then multiply them, and then the problem will be getting the original back. But primes, there is our first issue. What is a prime number? Everybody knows what a prime number is? Is one a prime number? No, one is not a prime number, one is a unit. But a prime number is a number bigger than one, or not a unit, or whatever you want to call it, that is only divisible by one and by itself. So 2, 3, 5. 2 is the only even prime number, obviously, because every other even number is divisible by 2, so by default it's not a prime number, and then you have many more. So how do we find these large numbers, these large prime numbers? Well, let's see. We generate an odd, if it's large, so it's not 2, it should be an odd number. So we just generate a random large odd number. Yeah, how many bits should it be? Let's say 512 bits. 512 bits prime. I just generate randomly 512 bits. Starts with a 1, otherwise it's less bits. Ends with a 1 because it should be odd. Yeah, and then when I have that number, I'll check if it's prime. If it's prime, perfect. And I'm done. If it's not prime, I'll just increase that number by 2, so I get the next odd number again, and I'll repeat this. Hey, the new number I just got, is this prime? No, if not, I'll just add 2. Yeah, so in principle, in this large list of all numbers, I'll start at some point, and then if I start looking for the first prime bigger than the one I originally started with. That's what I do. Prime number theorem says something about how many primes of a particular length exist. On the exam, you don't have to prove this this theorem, but know that if M is in the order of 1,000 bits, then there is approximately every one prime in every 693 numbers. So I have to repeat that step 2 quite a lot of times. But at some point, I will find a prime. How do I know when I hit a prime? How can I determine that a given number is a prime? Yeah, I can check if it's divisible by alpha primes. Yeah, but that takes a lot. That takes a lot of time. So there are some tests. Fermat is a very easy test, but it's not giving the best result. And there are some tests that are a bit more complicated that will give you good results. Let's first look there's some more. None of these are probabilistic. So for none of those, I can be absolutely sure that the number I see that the test says is a prime, that it is actually a prime. But I can make the probability that I make an error extremely small by just doing more tests. If it's a composite number and the test says it's composite, it is 100% certain it's composite. So this is Fermat's theorem. If I have a prime number p, and I take an arbitrary number between 1 and p minus 1, then if I raise that number that I just generated to the power of p minus 1 modulo p, I'll get 1. So by default, I know 7 is a prime. So 3 to the power 7 minus 1 modulo 7 equals 1. I don't even need to check this. You can check this if you're not sure. Yeah, just try this. 3 to the power 6 modulo 7 will be equal to 1. 7 is a prime. Fermat was correct. So 3 to the power 6 modulo 7 will be equal to 1. That holds for prime numbers. That doesn't hold. It holds sometimes also if p is not a prime, but if this was a composite number. Sometimes it's 1, but most of the times it will not be 1. So that's what the Fermat test is based on. I have a number that I want to test. I call that m. I want to know if m is prime. And so I generate a random a, and I raise a to the power m minus 1. And if the result is 1, actually I'm not sure. For a prime, yeah, I knew it would be 1. For a composite, it could be 1, but it could also be something else. If the result of a to the power m minus 1 modulo m is not 1, I for sure know that it is not a prime. It's a composite number. If it is 1, if that result of that calculation is 1, well, it's likely to be a prime. But let's try a few other values of a. Yeah, so I keep repeating with more and more values of a. Yeah, if a is a composite number, at some point I hopefully hit a value of a that will show me that the result of this modulo calculation is not equal to 1, and yeah, then I know it's composite. But if I over and over see that the result of whatever a I generate, that a to the power m minus 1 modulo m is equal to 1, I get more and more confidence that this is a prime. So we take the prime p is 19, and indeed, if you calculate p to the power 18 modulo 19, you get 1. Perfect, that's what we wanted. Let's test the prime 15. And we see that 2 to the power 14, m minus 1, modulo 15, is 4. Ah, it's not 1. At that point in time, the Fermat algorithm tells me that, or the Fermat test tells me that m is 15 is not a prime. Correct. I know that 15 is not a prime. Let's see. M is 341. I do 2 to the power 340, modulo 341 is 1. Okay, that could very well be a prime. It's actually not. It is a composite number, 11 times 31. So that's what I meant. So this, write the general one. This always holds for primes. But sometimes if p is not a prime, but it's a composite number, it still holds. As we can see here. For m is 341 and a is 2. Then let's generate, for this m value, let's generate another a value. Yeah, we'll just repeat it again. Let's look at 3 to the power 340 modulo 341. Oh, that's 56. Ah! Although I first thought it was a prime and I would just did some more checking to be sure. Second time that I try, I discover that it actually is not a prime. It's a composite number. I can stop. M is 341. It's not a prime. Yeah, so we had that before on the previous slide. We call the number 2 actually a false witness for the number M. Yeah? A is 2 is telling me that 341 is prime, but it's lying. It's not true. Or M, the other way around, we call M a pseudo-prime for the base 2. There are actually composite numbers that will always give me the result equal to 1 for whatever A I pick. Those are called Carmichael numbers. And so it could be, those are very, very rare, by the way. So it could be that I pick a number which is not a prime, for which this test will over and over again tell me that, yes, this is a prime, this is a prime, this is a prime. And so the Fermat test actually is not used. This is the smallest Carmichael number, but there are very, very few of them. Very, very sparse, I should say. There are many of them. Because the Fermat test has this problem, there is another test, which is called the Rabin-Miller. Solovay's trust, and I'll skip. I'll just explain this Rabin-Miller. They made a small modification to the Fermat test, and they say, okay, P minus P is a prime, or I'm testing if it's a prime, but it's an odd number anyway. So P minus 1 actually is even. Yeah, and so I can write P minus 1. It has a factor of 2 in it. Or maybe more. Maybe it has, let's say, R factors. What was it? What did I pick? S factors. S factors of 2, and then some odd number R. I can do that. And S is at least 1, we know. And what they do is they don't calculate A to the power P minus 1, and look if that is 1, but they look a bit further back, and they start with A to the power, I can now write A to the power P minus 1 as A to the power R to the power 2 to the power S. That's the same. And they first start calculating A to the power R. If this is 1 already, yeah, then raising it to any power of 2 doesn't matter anymore. 1 to the power 2 is 1 again, and I'll stay at 1. Yeah, so if this part is 1, A to the power R, yeah, then this certainly holds. If this, or this raised to maybe not S, but this is S. If I start with something that is not 1, but I start squaring it, and if at some point I get to minus 1, before I have raised it all to the power P minus 1, yeah, then I'm fine too, because squaring it the next time, minus 1 squared will be 1. Yeah, it sounds a bit strange that you square something and you get minus 1, but remember you're working modulo something. So minus 1 is the same as P minus 1. So it's a normal value. Don't worry too much about that. Yeah, so this is the what Solovey, what Rabin and Miller came up with. And again, they start testing, and as long as a number, yeah, they pick the number, I named it P there, they pick the number P, and then they test it with a random A, and if that random A fulfills one of these two conditions, say, okay, it could be prime. I'll pick another A. And I keep repeating that over and over again. However, for Rabin-Miller, we know that if this is the full set of numbers that I can test, these are all my A values that I can randomly pick. At most, there is some false witnesses there. But the size of this one is at most 1/4 of the total set. So there is no composite number where all the A values will tell me that it is prime. At most, 1 out of 4 will tell me that it is prime. All the others will tell me, no, it's a composite number. Those two conditions are not satisfied. None of the two conditions is satisfied. So if I would try all the values of A, I certainly would detect that the number I'm testing is not prime, that it is composite. Yeah. But in principle, every time that I do a test, I take a value of A and I'll do this test, and it tells me that it could be a prime, I actually have at most a probability of 1 over 4 that was a wrong conclusion. So if I run the test twice, and twice I get the test telling me that yes, this is a prime, or it could be a prime, after two times I have a probability of 1 over 4 squared, so 1 over 16, that I'm actually making the wrong conclusion. And if three of the tests tell me that it's prime, it's a probability of 1 over 64. So if I repeat this over and over again, I can make that probability that I make an error as arbitrarily small as I want. Yeah. So that's how this test works. There is an implementation. I think, I'm not sure if I copied it from the book that you have or from another book, but it's not an easy implementation. Okay, let's go back to RSA. This is where we were. Choose two large primes, P and Q. And we now know how to do that and to make sure that these primes are prime. So what do we do next? Well, we had to calculate the product, P times Q. And we can do that. Huge numbers, 1,000 bits each. I can do the multiplication. There is an efficient algorithm for that. But once I have that result, 2,000 bits, and I give it to you, you can't factor it anymore. I also calculate what is called phi of n. Phi of n is the Euler-Totian function, which is simply P minus 1 times Q minus 1. Okay, sidestep, because that might be a new concept. So what is this? This Euler-Totian function is an indication of how many numbers between 1 and n are relatively prime to n. So for example, if I take the number 6, What is the GCD of 1 and 6? Yeah, that's 1. Okay, 1 and 6 are relatively prime. What is the GCD of 6 and 2? What is the greatest common divisor between 6 and 2? That's 2, right? These are not co-prime. There's no. Greatest common divisor between 6 and 3, that's 3, okay, not co-prime. 6 and 4, that is 2. 2 is the divisor of 4, and 2 is the divisor of 6. Yeah. Not co-prime. Greatest common divisor between 6 and 5 is 1. Oh, these two are co-prime. So, actually, two numbers. The phi of two numbers between 1 and n minus 1 are in fact co-prime with n. That's the definition of the phi function. Some facts: if I would have started with a prime, then actually all these numbers are co-prime with that prime, because a prime is just divisible by two numbers, 1 and itself. So any number between 1 and p minus 1 can't be a divisor. Can't have any factors in common with P. If n is a power of a prime, then I easily can also calculate that. If I have two numbers that are co-prime by themselves, then the phi of n times m is the phi of n times the phi of m. And from that and the previous one, we can actually derive some more facts. But now, we started with a number n, that was actually P times Q. P and Q are primes. They're co-prime to each other, right? The only divisors of P is 1 on P, and the only divisors of Q is 1 on Q, so the greatest common divisor between P and Q is 1. They are co-prime. Okay, then I'll go to number 3. So the phi of n is then, in fact, the phi of P times phi of Q, which is, according to the first one, Right? As easy as that. That's the one that we calculated on the previous slide. So there are so many numbers between 1 and n minus 1 are co-prime to n. Which numbers are then not co-prime to n? Well, n is p times q. So p, the greatest common divisor of n and p, yeah, that's p, obviously. This is q times p, this is 1 times p, they both have p as a divisor. Actually, I could have here 2 times p. Yeah, p divides n, p divides 2p, etc. So which numbers are not co-prime with n? Well, that are, just for starters, all the multiples of p. p, 2p, 3p, all the way up to qp. And all the multiples of q, obviously. So there are p in total and q of the first one. Yeah, so in total, there are p plus q minus 1, because the last one, q times p, is the same as p times q. Yeah, all of these are not co-prime with n. Yeah, so if I subtract that number from n, then I have the numbers that are co-prime. Right? Well, n minus that number I just calculated, n minus p plus q minus 1, is in fact the same as p minus 1 times q minus 1. So at the very least, I'm not lying. Okay, we'll continue with RSA again. We had p, we had q, we could multiply them, we could calculate the Eudratugian function, the phi function. Phi of n is p minus 1 times q minus 1. Next, what we do is we select a random value e. There's one condition. That e should be relative prime to phi of n. Not n, phi of n. Why do I need that? Because I want to be able to calculate the inverse of e. I want to be able to calculate a value d such that e times d is 1 modulo phi of n. Yeah, so d is the inverse modulo phi of n of e. Two issues now. First, I said e is co-prime to phi of n. How do we check that? Co-prime means that the greatest common divisor of e and phi of n is equal to 1. So, okay, maybe we can check that. But then the next issue is, okay, once I have determined that, how do I get d from that? Okay, Euclidean, next side step. Euclidean algorithm. The Euclidean algorithm is the algorithm to calculate the greatest common divisor. So I have two numbers, a and b, and I can calculate that. And here is a general description of how to do that. This is a general description of the Euclidean algorithm. But there is also a version of the algorithm which is called extended Euclidean algorithm. And actually, once I've done that, it's not just that I have the greatest common divisor of A and B, but I can also express that greatest common divisor as a linear combination of A and B. So S times A plus T times B is equal to this greatest common divisor. Let's see how that works. An example works miracles here. Suppose I have the large number A is 3220, and I have a b which is 79. So how does the Euclidean algorithm work? Well, I'll express a as a multiple of b plus some remainder. So 3220 is actually 40 times 79, and then a remainder of 60. The remainder should always be between 0 and b minus 1. Well, I can do the same for the numbers 79 and 60. I can express 79 as 1 times 60 plus a remainder of 19. And I'll repeat it again with 60 and 19. 60 is 3 times 19 plus a remainder of 3. Okay, we'll continue. 19 is 6 times 3 plus a remainder of 1. I'll do it one more time. 3 is actually 3 times 1 and a remainder of 0. Once I get to the remainder of 0, I know that that previous remainder, 1 in this case, that's the greatest common divisor. Yeah, if you get to 1, you know that you have the greatest common divisor already. But so once I reach 0, I know that the greatest common divisor is in the line above it. So that's 1. Okay, that's good. So if phi of n would be 3,220, then I could have picked E equals 79, because that would be co-prime with phi of n. Right? That was the requirement. Yeah, so that's the conclusion. Let's look at the extended Euclidean algorithm. Actually, in the Euclidean algorithm, I'm working downwards. Extended Euclidean algorithm, you'll see that I will work upwards from the results I got so far. So I copied this in the from the previous slide in the red box. And from that, well, we'll forget about the last line. From the second but last line, I can express 1, which is the greatest common divisor. I can express 1 in terms of, 3 and 19. Yeah, I'm always trying to express it in the numbers where I have a dash beneath it. The other one are just factors. So 1 is equal to 19 minus 6 times 3. I'll just take the 6 times 3 and I'll bring it to the other side. Yeah, that's clear? Then I look one line up, and there is actually 3 in there. Yeah, and I can express from that line, I can express 3 as 60, minus 3 times 19. And I just plug that in. So 1 from the beginning is 19 minus 6 times 60 minus 3 times 19. Okay, I can modify that slightly. 19 times 19 minus 6 times 60. Yeah, remember, 19 and 60 are the important ones with the dash under it. The other ones are just factors. Okay, I'll look one line up. It expresses 19 in terms of 79 and 60. Okay, plug that in. And then we make it a bit more simple. We get to 19 times 79 minus 25 times 60. And you can do the calculation now and still see that the result is still 1. Again, we look at the first line. And we can express 60 in terms of 79 and 3,220. And we plug that in again and do the calculation, and we get this. Is that clear, what I did? So the Euclidean algorithm, we start with 3,220 and 79, and we work our way down up to till I have the GCD. And then the extended Euclidean algorithm is working up again. Yeah, every time that I have a simple expression, I'll use the next line, the previous line again. I'll work my way up. So actually, if A was 3,220 and B was 79, then I find that we wanted S times A plus T times B is equal to the GCD. Then actually I find that S is minus 25 and T is 1019. Yeah? So that's the extended Euclidean algorithm. Here we have it again. Here we have the final conclusion. Yeah? So now if phi of n was that 3,220. I got it from some example. I forgot where that example is. But if that phi of n was that value and E, the one that I picked, was 79, what would that mean for the value D? Well, we know that E times D, that was a requirement for D. E times D was 1 modulo phi of n. And Moses is in there already. If I take both sides of that equation, modulo phi of n, modulo 3,220, well, I can actually forget that minus 25 times that, because that's a multiple of 3,220, multiple of phi of n. So I'll forget about that. So actually, I'll see then that 1 modulo 3,220 equals 1,019 times 79. This was 79. 3, 2, 2, 0. So actually the value of D is this 1019. Yeah? Okay, back to RSA. We started with primes and we can prove that a prime is a prime. And we can generate them. We can calculate N, that was easy. We can compute phi of N, that was very easy because we have P and Q. We can pick an E that is relatively prime to phi of N. Yeah, pick an E, I'll check it. Oh, no, it's not relatively prime. I'll pick another one. Yeah, if you picked E is 2, phi of n is even, because P minus 1 and Q minus 1 is even, so phi of n is even. If I would have picked 2, I would have been in trouble. Yeah, but I pick an E, and I check that it is relatively prime to phi of n. Okay, once I found one, I can calculate D also. It's a lot of work, a lot of calculations. But then I'm done. My public key will be E, the combination of the values for E and N, and my private key will be the combinations of D and N. Or actually, I can keep P and Q there also. If I have D, P, and Q, I can calculate N myself. But there's no need for that. I now just explain the setup of RSA. Not how to use it, just the setup. So now we have Bob again, who wants to send a message to Alice. And he looks up Alice's public key. That's a value E and a value N. The N is the modulus and E is the exponent. And so what Bob does is he makes a simple calculation. He calculates M to the power E modulo N. He has E, he has N from the public key. He has his own message M, so he can do this. And he sends that to Alice. We assume now that M is a message between 0 and N minus 1, of course. It's not 0, because if M was 0, then 0 to something, to whatever power, is 0 again. And yeah, you can easily find it back. Probably not good to encrypt the message M is 1 also. Yeah, but I pick a sensible value of M. And then I can encrypt it in this particular way. Alice gets a message from Bob. And then she looks up her own private key, D and N. And what she does is she calculates that ciphertext C to the power D, again modulo N. And she gets some message M prime. And then hopefully M and M prime are the same. Yeah, before when we talked about stream ciphers and we did the XOR, it was easy to check. This might be a bit more difficult. M prime, by definition, what I just said, is a ciphertext to the power D modulo N. You see that the algorithm is the same. I have a message and I raise it to a key, to an exponent modulo N. So I use the encryption or the decryption key and then I get a result. The algorithm is the same, but the key that I use, the exponent in particular, that's different. C was m to the power e modulo n. In fact, I just substituted that. There's nothing special here. Well, this is the same as m to the power ed. Yeah, something raised to a power, raised to another power, then you can multiply the powers. 7 to the power 3 raised to the power 5 is the same as 7 to the power 3 times 5. So m to the power ed modulo n. We know something about e times d. Oh, where is it? Here. E times d is 1 modulo phi of n. So actually I can write e times d as 1 plus some multiple of phi of n. I don't know what the value of k is, but it is a multiple of phi of n, right? Because if I reduce this modulo phi of n, I'm just left with 1. So that's just plugging in that I knew that I constructed E times D in this way. Okay. I can write this, again, simple mathematics. This is something you should know. I can write this as M to the power 1 times M to the power K times phi of N. And then the same trick that I did in the beginning, but the other way around. I can write that last part as M to the power phi of N raised to the power K k. I don't know what value of k that is. But actually, I don't know, need to know what value of k that is. In Fermat, it's gone now. Fermat said a to the power p minus 1 modulo p is equal to 1. It's equal to 1. Right? Actually, that holds only if p is prime. If p is not prime, if p is some general value, then we get this. A to the power of phi of n is equal to n. So it's a generalization of this Fermat theorem. If n is a prime, yeah, then phi of n was p minus 1, or n minus 1. Yeah, I get the same. Yeah. So this is a special case of this. But m to the power of phi of n modulo n, then by default is 1. Okay. So I have m times 1 to some power k, and I don't know k, but that doesn't matter, because 1 to whatever power still is 1. So I get m back. Ah, that's good. At least when we do decryption, we get back to the same same plain text. That's good. So let me see what the time is. I'm using up a lot of time. Next time you just tell me that I'm way over time. Let's have a short, let's say 5 minute break, just to stretch legs, and then we'll quickly continue because there's still a lot of slides to go over. Yeah? Any questions so far? Yeah? Yeah, so that's the question was for the online audience: is there a test that determines a prime 100% certainty? You mentioned it already. It's testing dividing by all the smaller primes. Well, not all. You can stop at a certain point, but yeah. So that's certainly for these lengths, it's undoable when you talk about hundreds of bits. Yeah, so you can't get 100% certainty, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay. Other questions or not? Okay, then let's quickly have a short break. Okay, thanks for coming back so quickly. I've skipped a few slides. If you go to the slide deck, you'll see that I also went into the topic of how to do modular exponentiation, and I have an example of RSA. Just go over these and see if there are questions, then we can ask them. You can ask them at the exercise session tomorrow. I guess most of it speaks for itself anyway. Then the other topic, which is more important to discuss now, is Diffie-Hellman. Diffie-Hellman is not so much a key, it's not so much an encryption system as it is a key exchange algorithm. So I can use Diffie-Hellman to make sure that at some point in time, two people will have the same key. These keys can then be used for normal symmetric crypto systems. In Diffie-Hellman, the setup is that there will be a prime Q, and there will be a base alpha which generates actually all the numbers between 1 and Q minus 1. I will not go into detail about that. And the mathematics behind Diffie-Hellman, why it works, is actually the fact that a to the power n, and that raised to the power m, that's the same as a to the power n times m. But also if I start with a to the power m, and I raise that result to the power n, I get the same result. That's the basis why Diffie-Hellman works. So let's see how the protocol works. We have Alice, and we have Bob, and both of them have this generator, alpha, and both of them have the prime Q. Alice generates a random number A between 1 and Q minus 1, and B does, Bob does the same. He generates a small b. And then they start doing calculations. Bob calculates B, capital B, which is alpha to the power small b modulo Q. Alice does the same thing for her value. Alpha to the power small a modulo Q. Yeah, so now Bob has alpha and Q, and small b and capital B, and Alice has alpha and Q, as everybody, and small a and capital A. Alpha and Q are not secret. Those are system parameters. Actually, A is not, capital A is not secret because Alice is sending that to Bob. So Eve or whoever can see that. And Bob does the same. He takes his capital B and sends that to Alice. So I have some more information already. Now what Alice does is she calculates capital B, what she just got from Bob, and she raises that to the power A, which is her secret. Nobody else except Alice has that. Modulo Q. And Bob does similar. He gets the capital A from Alice, and he raises that to his own secret B, small b, modulo Q again. In both cases, they calculate the value alpha to the power small a times small b, modulo Q. Yeah, for example, Bob, he got capital A, which was alpha to the power small a. He raises that to the power b, so that is alpha to the power a times b. And similar for Alice. Okay. So Alice and Bob now have the same key. That's good. And they can use that for their communication. Eve, or anybody, knows alpha, knows Q. They can see A and B when they are transmitted, but nothing more. They don't have the secret small a or the secret small b that Alice has or Bob has. The only known way to get, in fact, that key, K, from all these values, from the values that Eve has, so alpha Q, capital A, and capital B, is actually to try and figure out small a from capital A or small b from capital B. Alice and Bob did modular exponentiation. Eve needs to do discrete logarithm, so the opposite. Yeah, remember that from the first few slides in the beginning. Yeah? That's a difficult problem. The only way that Eve can solve that is just try one by one. There's a small example. We take alpha is 2 and the prime q is 37. We can test that for primarity very easily, but we know this. Alpha is a generator of f 37 star. Don't mind the notation. It just means that if I calculate alpha to the power 1 modulo q, alpha to the power 2 modulo q, alpha to the all the way up to alpha to the power q minus 1 modulo q, I should actually see all these numbers 1, 2, 3 up to q minus 1. If I don't see all of them, I will just see half of them. They are repeated, or less even. Here's a small MATLAB script to just check that, but you don't need to do that. Now Alice, as in this example, Alice selects her secret 15, and she calculates 2 to the power 15, modulo 37, modulo q, right? And she gets 23, and that's what she, you can again check that with a MATLAB script, and she sends that to Bob. Bob selected his secret B is 21, and he does the same calculations, he gets 29, he sends that to Alice. Bob got number 23 from Alice, and he raises that to his own secret 21. And if he does that calculation correctly, he gets 6. Again, just look at the MATLAB script. You can check these numbers by yourself, or by hand even. You can check these by hand. And in fact, Alice got the same secret key. Everybody else just knows alpha is 2 and q is 37 and just sees these numbers that Bob and Alice sent, 23 and 29. They can't get to the key 6 from that. In this case, they can because it's a small example, but in a general case, they can't. So they, Alice and Bob share the key 6. That was simply Diffie-Hellman. There's not a lot to that. I can use Diffie-Hellman to exchange a key. Is this a secure protocol? I'm Bob. I'm getting some value 23 from Alice. Is it certain that that is Alice that sent me 23? Maybe Alice sent me 17. And then Eve came and took 17 from the transmission channel and just inserted 23. Because she just selected randomly 15 and she calculated 23. And so all of a sudden Bob is exchanging a key with Eve and not with Alice. There's no authentication or anything on these numbers. And so that's not part of this protocol. But if you want to use Diffie-Hellman, it should be embedded into a secure protocol, of course. Anyway, that's a sidestep. Let me go to signatures. Cryptographic signatures in this case. I mentioned in the beginning, symmetric crypto can be used for confidentiality only, but asymmetric crypto can be used for more things. We could use it for integrity and authentication also. I mentioned that before already. So integrity means making sure that the message is not changed, and changes can be deliberate or undeliberate. Yeah, but anyway, at the very end, I need to check if there is something changed. And authentication has to do with the problem I just said. If Bob receives a value, capital A, from Alice, he must make sure that actually that was a value coming from Alice and not just from somebody else. So making sure that the message really comes from the person we intended, that we think that it comes from. In this case, I will talk about integrity, and I don't care about confidentiality in the next few slides. Yeah. Here, actually, we start using the hash functions. Now you see where we can use a hash function. There is a hash function, any general hash function, and Alice wants to say the message M to Bob, and she has the message, and she can calculate the hash of the message. And so if she sends both of them, then Bob can, at the very end, he gets that, and he has the message also. He can calculate also the hash, and he can check if the hash is correct. Because if the message changes, there's one bit change in the hash, in the message, then half of the bits in the hash are changed, right? Avalanche effect. Yeah, so Bob can now check if he got the correct message. If he finds that the hash value is correct, the hash that he calculates on the message, he finds that that is the same hash as Alice sent in her message, said, okay, that's good. Well, maybe it's not that easy. No, life is not that easy. Because if Eve is smart, she doesn't just change the message. She just adds a new hash to it also. She doesn't want that Bob knows message M. She wants that Bob knows some message M0. It's a hash function. She calculates the hash. Let's say it's SHA-1 or whatever, MD5. She just calculates on that new message that she wants to tell to Bob, while Bob thinks it's from Alice. She just calculates a new hash and sends that. So she doesn't just change the message, she also changed the hash function. So in that simple form, at least it doesn't work. You don't even need to be smart to do this. So somehow, the hash is there to make sure that the message doesn't change, but somehow I need to have some integrity protection on the hash also again. I can use a hash again on the hash. That's kind of cyclic. That doesn't really help. So one way is using a keyed hash. Because then Eve has a problem. Because if the hash is keyed, in order to calculate on that message M0 a hash, yes, she needs a key, which she doesn't have. Only Bob and Alice have that key. So that could be something. Asymmetric crypto could be another way of doing this. We have a message, and we calculate the hash on that message. And then Alice is sending this message, right? She has her private key. And actually what she does is she encrypts the hash with her private key. Not Bob's public key, her private key, because she is the only one that has that key. And so she sends not the message concatenated with a hash, no, she sends the message concatenated with the encrypted hash. Encrypted with her private key. The only person that has that key is Alice. Now Bob receives that message. He can calculate the hash on the message again. But he has then the hash on that message, but he has the encrypted hash from the transmission. Oh, but it was encrypted with Alice's private key. Oh, but I can decrypt that. I can undo that encryption by using Alice's public key. That's available. I have that one. So Bob looks at the encrypted part, the encrypted hash, uses Alice's public key to undo the encryption and has the hash value again. So on the one hand, he calculated the hash on the message himself. On the other hand, he has the encrypted hash that Alice created, and he decrypts that, and then he sees that these two values are the same. Or if these two values are the same, then he accepts that this message is correct. That there were no change in the hash. So here you see it a bit in the picture. There's a message, Alice does the hash of that message, and then she uses her private key to encrypt that, and that encryption is added to the message. And Bob hashes the message and decrypts the hash, and then if he gets the same, then he accepts the message, and if it's different, then he doesn't accept the message, of course. The only one who could have created that encrypted hash is Alice. Because she is the only one who has her private key. So on top of integrity, I also get authenticity. Because the only one who could have created that message that is transmitted is Alice. Nobody else. Correct?
Already. And the change, that's the same. And this is what I just said. Bob can check that it is from Alice. So we get integrity and authentication.
I'm simply using asymmetric crypto. Symmetric crypto was not possible. Asymmetric it is. That's not true. I could do this also with symmetric crypto, by the way. But then I must make sure that there is a key, again, that Bob and Alice have together, which nobody else has. The only thing that we get with asymmetric crypto that we don't get with symmetric crypto, in symmetric crypto, Bob could make a message and claim that it was from Alice. Because he has the key also. Yeah? In asymmetric crypto, it's simple. Bob cannot make that same signature as Alice. That's called a signature, the dark part after the message. We call that a signature. So with asymmetric crypto, we get both integrity checking and authenticity. So that's called a symmetric. It's called a digital signature, as I just said. Why do we need to include the hash? Why not? Yeah. So we have the message, we hash it, and then we encrypt that hash. Why don't we encrypt the full message? Okay, no, but I'm not concerned about confidentiality here, right? So I'm not encrypting the message in the vertical path. I'm actually talking about, I take the message, I hash that, and then I encrypt that so I have the signature. So why is the signature on the hash and not on the full message? It says faking on top. That has something to do with it. It is because then Eve can create a message that is fake but looks real. So how does she do that? Well, actually, she goes the other way around. She generates first a digital signature, S. So S is just a random string. But if it's a random string, I can interpret that as the encryption of some kind of message with the private key of Alice. I don't know the private key. I don't know what the message is. But I can just randomly select a string. And then if I decrypt that randomly selected string with Alice's public key, I'll get something. And I call that the message. So I'll put that's probably a nonsense message. Probably just rubbish. But it is a message. This M that I got, created from this randomly generated S, that message, if Alice would sign that message, M, she would actually get that S as a signature. Is that clear? I've now created a pair, message and signature, both meaningless probably, at least the message is meaningless. Yeah, but I have created something that would be accepted by the other party because they see a message, and they see a digital signature, and they see if they decrypt the digital signature, they get the same message. So they would accept that. The fact that it is nonsense, that's a different thing. Yeah, could do harm anyway. Yeah, so not likely that M is meaningful. But if I try a lot of times, maybe I get something that at least is up to some level harmful. So that's why we include the hash, because then that path is stopped. Because I can just generate a random string, signature, and then I can decrypt that to get what should be the hash. Well, I would be lucky if I get something that is exactly 160 bits long or 256 bit long as the hash would tell me to. Before I just talked about the integrity and the authenticity, right? Now we also want to have some security. So we want to have confidentiality of the message on top of that.
Let's see how we do that. I think this picture tells the story.
I'll start with the message again. And that message, I'll append a digital signature in the way that I just talked about. And once I have that message with the signature, I start encrypting that. Yeah. How do we encrypt that? If I encrypt that with asymmetric crypto, well, it might be a long message, might take a lot of time. So I prefer to encrypt my message with a symmetric system, symmetric crypto. I can do that. I need a key. Yeah, but we haven't agreed on a key, and I don't want to use Diffie-Hellman. No, don't worry. I'll just generate a random key. I'll take my message with the signature here, and I'll generate a random key, and I'll encrypt that message with a random key. Oh, wait. In order for you to be able to read it again, you should know what the key is. Okay, so I'll take the key, and I'll encrypt the key. I encrypt it with your public key. So the symmetric key is encrypted with the public key of the receiver, who is the only one who can read that message, who can decrypt that message. That's the one who has the private key. So if I want to send it to you and I use your public key, he can't use that because he doesn't have the private key to unlock that. Yeah, so that small part on top of this fourth picture, that's the encrypted key. You are the one who can decrypt that part. You can find the key, then you can decrypt that big message again, and so you get back to the second picture and you can check the signature and everything. So if I want, on top of integrity and authenticity, if I also want confidentiality, then this is the smartest way of doing it. There are different ways, but this is a smart way of doing that. Is that clear? For the same reason as the attack I just described, when you don't use a hash, you don't want to first take the text and encrypt that text, and then do the integrity on that, the signature on that. You first do the signature, and then you do the encryption. Sign and encrypt, not encrypt and sign. That's a security reason. I have a number of. That was about signatures. Any questions about that? Last few slides is on key distribution. We talked about key distribution last week when we talked about symmetric. And then I showed you that the more people we have, the more keys I need. N people need approximately in the order of n squared keys. Yeah. So if you have a larger community, that number of keys explodes. If we have a community, the same size community, but we use asymmetric crypto, well, everybody just has one key pair. For me, I have one key, which is a public key and a private key. It's not two keys; it's one key. It's a key pair. They are linked, right? So, at the very least, hopefully, this is easier for asymmetric crypto to deal with all these keys. Okay. So what does Alice do? She has a public key, and she publishes it in some kind of directory or on her website or whatever. But the thing is that if I want to send a message to Alice, I'll go to her website and I'll retrieve the public key and I'll use that to do the encryption. But if Eve was just there before me and she took away the information that Alice put there, and she put a fake public key there, one that she actually has the related private key to, I wouldn't know that. So I would be using that public key to encrypt the message that I sent to Alice, but actually the one who was able to read that would be Eve and not Alice. Yeah, you could detect it at that point in time, but yeah. So somehow we need certainty that if I see a public key, that is in fact the public key of the person that I want to have the public key from. So the way that we do that is to make what we call certificates. And a certificate is a set of information. So there is an identity of Alice, and there is the public key of Alice. And then there is some kind of integrity of that information behind it. So there is some kind of higher power that makes a signature on this initial information, identity of Alice and the public key of Alice. A higher power signs this information and adds it as a signature to the message. Yeah, so the identity of and the public key of Alice, that's the message, and the signature is made by some kind of a higher power. Yeah, and then I can go and I check, and I know this is done with the private key of the higher power. So I take the public key of the higher power, and I check indeed that is the encrypted the hashed of the encrypted information in the beginning. I say okay, then it's correct because I trust this higher power. I now know that I have the correct information on the public key of Alice. Yeah. How do I check that? Well, I'll just look up the public key of the higher power, and I'll use that to do the decryption. Yeah, and then I have a problem because how can I be sure that I have the correct public key of the higher power? Okay, well, let's take an even higher power, and that even higher power signs the public key of the higher power. And yeah, I still got a problem. So there is some. Let me see. Let me have this as a short step in between. This is X509 certificates. These are very widely used. You see a structure in there. You see that the identity of the person is in there. There is a validity period, such that if I see that the certificate is used after the validity period, I don't trust it anymore, etc., etc. That was just a small sidestep. Let's go back to the higher power. How can we be certain that the public key of the higher power is correct? We'll use an even higher power. And then he signs a public key of the higher power, etc., etc. We can do this for a while. There is generally a structure like this, which what we call a public key infrastructure. We have users here at the bottom, and their certificates are signed by a higher power, and the certificates of these higher powers are again signed by an even higher power, and then we go up this inverse tree, and then at the very top there is the ultimate power, and the ultimate power signs his own certificate. But because the root CA, these are called certificate authorities, the root certificate authority, he is very well known. So it's not something that people can easily change. Yeah. So at some point, I must trust the certificate of the CA, and then I can trust everything that falls beneath that. So how does it work for Alice and Bob? We see Alice and Bob here. Bob might be on a different level as Alice. That doesn't really matter. But Bob has a but he has a certificate authority above him, and he trusted certificate authority because that's the person that signed his certificate. So he trusts that guy, and then he sees that actually that certificate authority also signed certificate of the red CA. Okay, I trust that blue guy because that blue guy, I know that blue guy's public key, and I see that he used that to sign the red public key. So okay, now I know that I have the correct public key of the red CA. Yeah, and because that one again is used to sign, let me see, where were we there? That is used to sign the public key of Alice. Okay, I know that I indeed have the correct certificate of Alice. So this is a nice infrastructure used, and this is more the same story. Yeah, and we can use that to make sure that if people don't have direct contact, they still can use this structure to check each other's certificates. There are different possibilities other than public key infrastructures. The other option is called a web of trust. So So in a PKI, you must trust somebody. In the very end, you must trust the roots, eh? But what if there is a person and he's a bit paranoid, and what if we have John, and John is a strong believer of conspiracies, yeah? America has never been to the moon, and 9/11, that was the CIA, right? Or the FBI, I don't know. Yeah, John is a believer of conspiracies. Obviously, John trusts himself. Yeah, if not, we have a completely different ballgame. John trusts himself. John trusts his friends, including cats. Yeah, because I know these guys, I trust these guys. Yeah, the other ones, well, I don't trust them. Yeah, as far as he can see, his friends, he can trust. But because he trusts his friends, he also trusts the friends of his friends, even the ones he doesn't know. Yeah, so his trust spreads through his friends and his friends of his friends, etc., etc. So this goes on. So let's see how the web of trust works. So we have John, and John has two friends, Mike and Ken. And actually, Mike knows Ken also, but he also knows Ryo. And Ryo knows James and Mike, etc., etc. So here we have a diagram of the relations of these people. And now we have John. And John wants to talk to James. Yeah, but he doesn't know James. How can I trust James? Well, John trusts Ken. They are friends. Yeah, so John trusts Ken. But because Ken trusts James? Yeah, that means that John also will trust James. Yeah, that's the web of trust. And I was running out of tinfoil pictures. I luckily found Lucy also, a picture of Lucy. Yeah, same applies to Lucy, yeah? So web of trust just means that I don't trust you, but I know I trust you, and because you trust him, I'll trust you too. Yeah? So it's transitive. There can be even more steps in between. Now it's a small diagram, but for example, Ryo and Lucy, they are a bit further apart, but they still trust each other because Ryo trusts James, James trusts Ken, and Ken trusts Lucy. And so Ryo trusts Lucy also. Yeah, so there's PKI is one commonly used way of doing this trust of these certificates, but there are alternatives. PGP, pretty good privacy, is based on web of trust. Yeah. Certificates that you use in your computer are generally based on these public key infrastructures. Any questions? I have to go a bit quick. Try to use fewer slides in the next coming weeks. It's a bit of testing for me also. It's a lot of information on crypto. Classical crypto systems in the beginning, then symmetric last week, and this week the hashes and the asymmetric. So, anything missing? Did you miss something in these? It's a bit difficult if you don't know what to miss, but... The example of the... I'm not sure if I will be present at the exercise session tomorrow, but Merita and Kyle will be, and so you can ask them questions. I will tell them that we did not cover those few slides. So go over them and see if you understand what's going on. A few slides on how to do the exponentiation, the modular exponentiation, and there is an example of our RSA where we really work with numbers. Yeah, just to make things a bit more tangible. Yeah. Questions? This was the last time that we'll talk about crypto, so I had to finish this today. Next week and the week after, we will go into authentication identification. Next week will actually be on authentication in general, a large part about passwords, and the week after will be on biometrics. The deadline for those who haven't, also online, for those who haven't delivered yet, please make sure that you deliver the first assignment before the deadline, 21st of September, if I'm not mistaken. Next week, you will be also given the second assignment. Again, there will be a 3-week delivery time for that also. Yeah, I'm working on that a bit still. So, has everybody here in class already finished the assignment? Maybe not delivered, but finished? Anybody not finished? Okay. You've got some work to do. Have you started? Okay. Did you like it? Was it too easy? Doesn't matter for you, but next year I can make it more difficult. How was it? Was it at a level that you say, no, this was too easy and I just 10 minutes and I was done? Or was it at something? Was it useful? That's interesting feedback for me. Also for the persons listen to the recording, if you have feedback on something that I do, please let me know. You had a... Okay. So next time it should be a bit more difficult. But I thought it was nice to get a practical touch with... Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah, but that's good because you use that for the remainder. If you go to the technology track, certainly, and if you go to the digital forensics track, most likely also. But MATLAB is something that you will be using in the remainder of your studies also. If you go management... Yeah, that might not be that useful, but anyway, you learn something. I had another question, another remark, which I forgot. Yeah, I sent out a message, or I put a comment in the Blackboard room about the reference group. I had some people replying already to that, but please have a look at that. That's the NTNU system requires that there is a group of 3 students. That's called a reference group, and the reference group has to be in close contact with me as a teacher and probably with Kyle and Marita as TAs to do the evaluation of the course. There will be 3 small meetings during the semester. Yeah, such that I also can steer the quality of the course during the semester instead of just at the very end know what I can do, not better for you, but for the other group, for the next year's group. So, yeah, I've got some feedback on that already, but if there are more people that are interested in joining, that would be great. Just send me an email on that. Yeah, that's more or less it. Yeah? Okay, thanks for your attention.